Luke chapter 4 at the beginning. Sorry, not at the beginning, at verse 14. In a couple of sermons recently, we've looked at the story of Naaman in the book of Kings, and we find here in Jesus's first recorded sermon preached in his hometown of Nazareth, Jesus refers to Naaman. Luke 4, verse 14. Jesus returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit, and news about him spread through the whole countryside. He taught in their synagogues, and everyone praised him. He went to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom, and he stood up to read. The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. The eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him, and he began by saying to them, "Today, this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." All spoke well of him and were amazed at the gracious words that came from his lips. "Isn't this Joseph's son?" they asked. Jesus said to them, "Surely you will quote this proverb to me, 'Physician, heal yourself.' Do here in your hometown what we have heard that you did in Capernaum." "I tell you the truth," he continued, "no prophet is accepted in his hometown. I assure you that there were many widows in Israel in Elijah's time, when the sky was shut for 3.5 years and there was a severe famine throughout the land. Yet Elijah was not sent to any of them, but to a widow in Zarephath in the region of Sidon. And there were many in Israel with leprosy in the time of Elisha the prophet, yet none of them was cleansed, only Naaman the Syrian." All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of the town, and took him to the brow of the hill on which the town was built in order to throw him down the cliff. But he walked right through the crowd and went on his way. This is God's word. In the second book of Kings, as I say, we've looked at Naaman in a couple of morning services recently, but I want to just read various verses from 2 Kings chapter 5. First of all, we'll read verses 1 to 8. To remind us of the basic story, and then we'll jump on to verse 15 to read what happened after Naaman was healed by washing or dipping in the River Jordan. 2 Kings 5. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram, victory over Israel, amongst others. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands from Aram had gone out and had taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter I am sending my servant Naaman to you so that you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes, a sign of great grief and mourning and distress, and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of his leprosy? See how he is trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent him this message: "Why have you torn your robes? Make the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." And so the story goes on, and Elisha tells him to wash 7 times in the Jordan, and eventually Naaman does that and is healed. Verse 15, "Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, 'Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel. Please accept now a gift from your servant.' The prophet answered, 'As surely as the Lord lives whom I serve, I will not accept a thing.' And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. 'If you will not,' said Naaman, 'please let me, your servant, be given as much earth as a pair of mules can carry, for your servant will never again make burnt offerings and sacrifices to any other god but the Lord. But may the Lord forgive your servant for this one thing. When my master enters the temple of Rimmon to bow down, and he is leaning on my arm and I bow there also, when I bow down in the temple of Rimmon, may the Lord forgive your servant for this. Go in peace,' Elisha said." After Naaman had traveled some distance, Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said to himself, "My master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean, by not accepting from him what he brought. As surely as the Lord lives, I will run after him and get something from him." So Gehazi hurried after Naaman. When Naaman saw him running towards him, he got down from the chariot to meet him. "Is everything all right?" he asked. "Everything is all right," Gehazi answered. "My master sent me to say, 2 young men from the company of the prophets have just come to me from the hill country of Ephraim. Please give them a talent of silver and 2 sets of clothing." "By all means, take 2 talents, said Naaman. He urged Gehazi to accept them, and then tied up the 2 talents of silver in 2 bags with 2 sets of clothes. He gave them to 2 of his servants, and they carried them ahead of Gehazi. When Gehazi came to the hill, that is the hill near where Elisha and he lived, he took the things from the servants and put them away in the house. He sent the men away, and they left. Then he went in and stood before his master Elisha. 'Where have you been, Gehazi?' Elisha asked. 'Your servant didn't go anywhere,' Gehazi answered. But Elisha said to him, 'Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? Is this the time to take money or to accept clothes, olive groves, vineyards, flocks, herds, or manservants and maidservants? Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever.' Then Gehazi went from Elisha's presence, and he was leprous, as white as snow." Amen. Bibles to 2 Kings, chapter 5, and to verse 27, the last words of Elisha to Gehazi: "Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever." Then Gehazi went from Elisha's presence, and he was leprous, as white as snow. You can't blame Naaman for what happened to Gehazi. Oh yes, as we'll see, there was a degree of confused thinking and superstition in Naaman bringing with him all that wealth in the form of money and clothes to use as gifts. But Naaman was just doing what he knew. He was seeking to follow through the little girl's advice. He meant no malice by it. What we have here is a story of one of the great sinners of the Bible. What happened to bring God's judgment upon him? And why God's judgment fell on him? I haven't got any PowerPoint today because there's really only three headings, and I hope you can remember them. The story, the mystery, and the challenge. The story of what happened to Gehazi and Naaman, the mystery of why God did this, and the challenge of what it says to us. So firstly, the story. How Naaman's triumph turned into Gehazi's tragedy. The story began in terms of Gehazi and his sin, that very moment when Naaman came back from the River Jordan, amazed and thrilled that his leprous skin, marred by that fungal, whatever infection it was, whatever particular form of leprosy was there, Naaman was thrilled because it had gone and he was clean. And he was so thankful. I wasn't here this morning, but I gather the theme this morning was the 10 lepers and the one who came back and said thank you. Isn't it fascinating that in the New Testament, the one who came back was a foreigner, a Samaritan. And in the Old Testament, the beginning of Gehazi's trouble, if you like, lay in Naaman's thankfulness to God for his healing and the thankfulness that he felt towards Elisha. And in his thankfulness, verse 15 of chapter 5, we read, he stood before Elisha and said, "Now I know that there is no God in all the world except in Israel." He came back and worshipped like the 10th leper to Jesus. And then he said, "Please accept now a gift from your servant." He makes an offer. Naaman came from a culture, a religious background that assumed that as far as the gods were concerned, you got what you paid for. It was, somebody's called it slot machine religion. You put some money in and God will bless you. The nearest horrible version of it today is the religion, the evangelist so-called, who tells you, "Send me money and you will prosper. Send me money and all your financial employment, whatever troubles, will be finished." That always has been an assumption of pagan religion. And Naaman setting out to find the healing that the young girl has spoken of to his wife. Naaman says, "Well, I'd better take plenty of coins for the slot machine with me." And not having credit cards in those days, he takes chariots full of money. It's rather difficult for us. Look at verse 5. Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver. Now, the best understanding, just an example of the silver, is that a talent was 75 pounds weight. And by my calculations from the internet's figures for the price of silver today in UK pounds, that means that in today's terms, Naaman took with him about 126,000 pounds worth of silver, not to mention gold. And then he also took with him these garments, They weren't just, you know, a pair of Levi's that he'd popped into the supermarket to buy on his way. No, Sarah and I were up at Dunrobin Castle on Friday, and there in the museum at Dunrobin, amongst all sorts of strange things, there's a cabinet with two long garments in. These were garments presented by to the Duke of Sutherland and the Duchess in the 1920s when they visited the King of Saudi Arabia. And there they are. These were in the Arabian way, the Middle Eastern way. They were given these gifts of garments. Now, they're not just ordinary clothes. They're embroidered with gold. They're sewn with jewels. They were king's clothing. They were probably worth, in our terms, tens and tens of thousands of pounds themselves. What man knows what expensive clothes are worth? But I'm just trying to say, you know, these weren't ordinary clothes. These were a king's ransom that Naaman brought with him. And you can imagine him kind of saying in his enthusiasm, Elisha, look, let me give you something. Let me give you a present now. But Elisha refuses. Elisha is so concerned that Naaman should know that his healing is not due to his wealth. God didn't heal him because he knew that Naaman would make a big contribution to funds. Naaman needs to know that his healing is not due to his power and influence. Nor is it due to the fact that he came upon a particularly skillful prophet who could do some amazing dramatic liturgy. Remember that Elisha hadn't even come out to speak to him. He just sent a message up, go and wash in the Jordan. Everything about the story of Naaman's healing was done by God in a way that would show that it was not by might nor by power, but by my spirit. That it was God's action and it was God's free gift. When John wrote his gospel, he says something similar in chapter 1 and verse 13. You know, to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God. Children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. No present needed, none will be accepted. Because Naaman, you need to be very clear that God has freely given you healing. God has done it for you, though you are a rich and powerful man, it's free, no charge. And Naaman, we read in verses 17 to 19, is treated as one of God's people. He himself now has a sense that he belongs to God. He hasn't bought that either. The business about the mule loads of earth was a way of saying, Naaman was saying, look, though I've got to go back and live in Syria, I want to be able to stand on the soil of God's land. And it was a symbolic way. I suppose today we might wear a little badge sometimes or put a sticker on the back of our car. But this was Naaman's way of doing it. I belong to God's people. I am in God's service. I belong to the God of Israel. And so Elisha sends him off when he has a query about what will happen when he goes into the temple with the king. He asks for forgiveness for doing that. And Elisha, it seems quite clear, accepts that. He says in verse 19, go in peace. And so Naaman goes back with his treasure untouched, with all the garments still in their polythene wrappings. But with, as one writer put it, but with the silver and the gold and the precious garments, there was now something else. Gehazi's heart was in Nathan's in Naaman's carts. Gehazi's heart had seen, Gehazi had seen the riches. And Gehazi was tempted. And Gehazi's heart went with the riches. And very soon, Gehazi went after Naaman. He was frustrated at what had happened. Verse 19, he says, "My master was too easy on Naaman, this Aramean. Should have stung him, not given it to him free. Why should he do that? He's not a Jew, he's an Aramean. This Aramean, this foreigner. Wasn't right." And Gehazi was desperate to get his hands on some of the money. He wasn't concerned for the wealth. He doesn't say, "Oh, my master could have used this money. He's poor, would have helped the ministry." No, he wanted it for himself. And so in his greed, he goes after Naaman. He seeks to deceive Naaman. Sorry, I keep saying Nathan. Translated, if I say it again. He keeps saying he deceives Naaman. Did he think Naaman was stupid? Two young men from the school of the prophets, two students from the Edinburgh Theological Seminary, have arrived at the manse. Could you please give them, about £50,000 of silver and a couple of royal robes? Doesn't make sense. Why would sons of the prophet want that when Elisha didn't want anything? But Naaman is generous. Naaman says, "No, you asked one, take two. Take two." Naaman is glad of the opportunity to show his thankfulness for his gifts. And so Gehazi comes back, and he's a sharp guy. He's aware, he's perhaps guilt makes you extra sensitive. But before they actually arrive at the house, he makes Naaman's servants stop and unload. And Gehazi staggers into the house, no doubt by the back door, and hides this stuff in his house. By the way, this whole story has great echoes of the story of Ananias and Sapphira in the New Testament, and of the man that David will no doubt be preaching about soon in Joshua, whose name escapes. Achan. Good, he's awake. That's great. Good. Thanks, David. But Achan steals and hides, and Gehazi deceives others. And then the blatant lies that come out. "Where have you been, Gehazi?" asks Elisha. Oh, what a tangled web we weave when first we practice to deceive, says one of Walter Scott's characters. And Gehazi gets deeper and deeper in the sheer deceitfulness and duplicity, two-faced crook. And he lies to Elisha. And Elisha pronounces judgment on him. Elisha says to him, verse 26, "Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you?" You forget, Gehazi, I'm a servant of God. You know, other stories about Elisha include that. He knew what the Syrian army was planning to do. God gave him that knowledge. And Elisha knew exactly what Gehazi had been doing. Not because Elisha is an amazing magician, but because God had revealed it to him. Gehazi may deceive Naaman. He may deceive others, but he cannot deceive God. God's sight sees everything. God sees not only what we do, what we don't want anybody else to see us doing. And God sees not only what we do, he sees what's in our hearts and what's hidden there. God's inescapable sight is then followed by God's severe judgment. Naaman's leprosy will cling to you and to your descendants forever. As Matthew Henry says in his old commentary, God said to Gehazi, if you want Naaman's wealth, then you must have Naaman's leprosy with it. Okay, that's the story. Let's move on quickly into the mystery. The mystery. And the mystery is, why was God so severe? It seems, it seems to us a cruel enough punishment to give a man leprosy, but to give it to him and his descendants, this is shocking. This is amazing. As is the story of Achan in Joshua and so on. These are the sort of stories people say that shouldn't be in the Bible. These are the stories that make people disbelieve the Bible. Murdo McLeod in Nairn was telling me that an atheist in America has produced a book mocking the Bible. It's sort of a children's story Bible that Christians will never use, because he says there's lots of stories in the Bible, and this would be one of them, that aren't in our Sunday school syllabuses. Or we tell the story of Naaman right up to the point where he's washed and goes away home, but we don't tell the story of Gehazi and the leprosy. Are we ashamed of it? Do we think the atheists or the opponents of the Bible have got a point when they say, how can you believe in a God who does cruel things like this? Why don't we teach this bit of the story in our Sunday school? Well, let's look at that. That's the mystery, and it is a mystery. It is a puzzle. And I'm sure that all of you that read your Bible seriously and carefully know that, you know, you think, yeah, it does trouble me. And by the way, don't fall into the trap of saying, oh, well, that's in the Old Testament. Because I've already mentioned Ananias and Sapphira, who fall down dead at the feet of Peter for lying to God about money. So what are we to make of this mysterious, this challenging thing? I'm going to say a few things now, but you know, sometimes we can raise questions in our preaching. Put questions into your minds, and then you feel, well, actually, I see the problem, but I didn't think he dealt with it very fully. I'm still not happy. If, after the sermon tonight, if when you think about this, I hope you will think about it in the coming days, if you've still got some problems and doubts and questions about this, do come back to me. I'm sure come back to David too, and ask us. And we'll do our best to answer them. These are difficult things. And they also, as we'll see even now, they pull in lots of threads. They are as profound as the mystery of sin and God's sovereign grace. But let's look at what we can say from this story that can say, why was God so severe? First thing I want to say very quickly is that greed is a dangerous temptation. Greed is a dangerous temptation. You and I find that difficult to grasp because we live in an age that, to quote somebody writing in the New York Times a few years ago, when the banks were all collapsing and the property bubble was bursting, he said the trouble is, the reality is, that the 1980s and the 1990s have done to greed what the 1960s did to sex. The 1960s, the sexual revolution and all that, said, look, there's nothing wrong here. There shouldn't be any laws about sexual activity. If it feels good to you, there's nothing to stop you. That's what the 1960s, broadly speaking, did to sexual activity. And the writer was saying the 1980s and the 90s did the same to greed. We live in a society that says, hey, get rich any way you can. It's often said in London, I don't know if the echo reaches as far as here, I've certainly heard the mayor of London saying this, the markets have no morality. That's the theory. The markets have no morality. And successive governments since the 1980s have abolished most of the restrictions and many of the rules that restricted financial transactions. And we've seen the result in a whole series, a new one just coming to the surface in the last couple of weeks, of bankers or investment bankers fiddling this, of toxic mortgages being hidden up, bound up in packages. Why? And why do people do it? Because everybody wants a big house, even if they can't afford it. So we go out and take mortgages that we have no hope of repaying. Why is it that there's so many adverts for gambling on the television? Because everybody wants to get rich. What's the reason for all those makeover programs or programs of people who buy a house and do it up and then sell it for twice as much more? Because we all want to get richer. Greed is a dangerous thing. What was it that Adam and Eve, that led Adam and Eve to sin? Was greed. They saw that the fruit was good to taste, that it would make men wise, that it would give them more power, as much power as God himself. And if you doubt the reality of greed, just listen to what the politicians say in their party conferences. Vote for us because we'll cut your taxes. Vote for us because we'll increase this or that or the other benefit to you. They offer us, in effect, riches in order to vote for us. They know that greed is a winner. A few years ago, Tim Keller in New York was preaching a series of lunchtime sermons on the seven deadly sins. And when he preached on the sin of lust, the building was packed. People flocked in to hear what he would say about that. When he preached on greed, it was the smallest attendance of the whole series. People don't want to be challenged about greed. People don't see greed as a sin. But this story is saying, hang on. If you think this was a bit over the top of God to punish Gehazi like he did, then maybe your estimation of greed is different from God's. The love of money is the root of all evil. And so many, if you read, for instance, some of the minor prophets, Amos and Micah, you'll find them saying things in Amos. There's a startling verse where he says, God is condemning Samaria, the very kingdom that Elisha was ministering in. You big people, you can't wait for the Sabbath to end so that you can make more money. You can't wait for the Christmas holidays to be over, or whatever their equivalent was, because you want to get back to making money by exploiting the poor. Greed is a dangerous temptation in God's estimation. But there's more than that here. You see, maybe you've already put two and two together. The evil of what Gehazi did also was this. Gehazi undermined Elisha's ministry. Naaman came, and one of the thoughts in his pagan educated mind was religion. Yeah, well, you pay them money and they do what they can for you. And Naaman was startled and surprised to find that the God of Israel did not work that way. The God of Elisha did not say, well, let's see your money and then I'll see what I can do. It'll cost you, but I'll do my best. He saw that Elisha operated differently. But now, just not long after he's left Elisha, up comes Elisha's servants and say, oh, my master sent me because he wants some money after all for a good cause. He needs some money. Please help. Do you not see that what Gehazi is doing is undermining all that Naaman has learned about God's grace and about Elisha's ministry? Elisha is different from any pagan priest, from any false prophet, but Gehazi makes him look as bad as the rest of them. The Apostle Paul faced the same problem. When you come to 2 Corinthians 12, you'll find Paul is saying, some of you I know are saying this, that this guy pretends not to be charging anything for us, for his ministry, but actually he's manipulating us. He's taking our money in other ways. And Paul says, it's not true. He's being maligned. His ministry is being attacked. And Gehazi's greed is an attack on the ministry of the gospel. And God acts strongly to deal with that. Because, you see, put it another way, Gehazi's greed obscures God's grace. Grace is free. We do not earn salvation. Somebody put it like this. If when Naaman had arrived at Elisha's house and said, please heal me of my leprosy, I've brought, you know, hundreds of thousands of gold and silver. If Elisha had turned around and said, it'll cost you twice that, do you know what Naaman would have done? He would have got back in his chariot, rushed back to Syria and got twice that and brought it along and said, here, I've done it. Now give me my healing. But God's grace is not like that. We like to think that it's what we can do. In a few moments, we'll be singing our last hymn, not what these hands have done. The truth is, we are beggars. We're not people coming to God and say, here, we've collected all our money. We pay it. Please give us what we need. We're not even kind of giving God a blank check, saying, Lord, if you give me forgiveness, I will come to church every Sunday. I will look after you. I will give you this. I will do this. I will serve you all my days. I'll do whatever you ask me. Blank check. God's grace is free because Jesus Christ pays the full price. And the evil of what Gehazi did and the reason for that severe punishment has to be seen in the light of the cross. What Gehazi is saying to Naaman and to the world is, you can pay for your own salvation. And that is a soul-destroying error that is blinding tonight millions of people around the world who are in the Muslim religion or the Hindu religion or all sorts of other religions, or who think that somehow, so long as they do their best, God, if there is a God, will let them into heaven. And the gospel says that is not true. However rich you are, however hard you work, you cannot pay for your own salvation. You must accept it as a humbled, free gift in Jesus Christ. And because God loves the world, because God longs to see sinners accepting his free offer of the gospel, that humbling, not to say humiliating offer, that was made to Naaman. All you have to do is go and wash in the River Jordan. You don't have to pay a penalty. Because God longs for people to accept that free offer, God is literally furious with anyone from among his people who obscures that truth and contradicts that truth by his lies. That's why it is a terrible thing to be a false prophet in the church of God. When I was a young man, I was thinking of Christian ministry. And I was a member in the Church of England. I was growing up. And a bishop of the Church of England said publicly and wrote it publicly, if anyone believes in justification by faith alone, that is that Jesus died in the place of sinners, he should see his psychiatrist as soon as possible. Now that's sin. That is a sin as great as Gehazi's, because it is turning people away from the grace of God. It's obscuring the grace of God. Well, the story, the mystery, the challenge. Let me just pull it together, because I've been giving you the challenge in there. You see, the thing that Gehazi hadn't realized was that he needed grace just as much as Naaman did. Gehazi thought that because he was a Jew, he was superior to this Syrian, this Aramean. He didn't realize that his sinful heart needed to be washed in the Jordan just as much as Naaman's did. That was the problem in Nazareth when Jesus preached there. You see, people like Gehazi and people like the citizens of Nazareth, and all too many in the Church of Jesus Christ today, forget that the church is not made up of people who are better than those nasty people outside the church. The church is just made up of beggars who've already been shown where to find free bread. And the church exists for the sake of the people who are outside it. Not to make itself more comfortable, not to enrich itself, but to serve those outside. It's very hard. Matthew Henry says somewhere that it's terribly possible that the nearer we are to church, the further we are from God. If we don't see that we too are sinners, we too need grace. The saddest part of this story is not that Gehazi was afflicted with leprosy. Naaman had had leprosy too. The saddest part of this story is that there is no record of Gehazi falling down on his knees before Elisha and say, "Master, you are just. You are right. I have committed a terrible sin. I have sinned against God. I have sinned against God's covenant. I have sinned against you. I have sinned against the truth. Oh, my master, is there mercy for me? Can I be forgiven? Can I be cleansed?" And just as Naaman was told, yes, Naaman, this is what you can do. Just go and wash in that river Jordan. What, that muddy stream, that pathetic. Jesus says to us, to the Gehazis of his church in all ages, yes, you need to realize there is forgiveness for you, but it involves you admitting that you are no better than the tax collectors and the prostitutes, the drug addicts, the most godless and wicked people out there. If you will fall down and see yourself in the light of the gospel and see yourself in total need of Jesus' forgiveness, then whether Gehazi is your first name or your unrecognized middle name, there is forgiveness for you. For Jesus said to Naaman's and to Gehazi's, "Come unto me. Why will you die? Why will you put yourself under the wrath of God? Why will you not come to me and find forgiveness and rest for your souls?" Naaman and Gehazi, triumph. The enemy of God's people, who found grace and healing through faith. Gehazi, the tragic member of God's church community, who found wrath because he didn't face up to his own sin and he could not see what was right before his eyes, that God is rich in mercy, all who call upon him to relieve. My friends tonight, have you cried to Jesus Christ to heal you of your leprosy, of that sin which clings to all of us and in which we are born? Jesus Christ is ready to wash you and cleanse you and make you new.